Hey guys, and welcome to another episode of Ireland Crimes and Mysteries. I want to thank you for joining me today, and if you're a returning listener, I want to say a big thank you for your continued support. If this is your first time listening to my podcast, welcome. It's great to have you on board. So without further ado, let's get started on today's story.
Today's case takes us back to County Kerry. If you travel to the small town of Rathmore today, it's still very much a place rooted in community and routine. Nestled in the countryside on the Kerry-Cork border, with the Slievelucra Hills in the background. But back in 1931, life there was even quieter. It was the sort of place where everybody knew each other by name, and news spread quickly. Not by radio or phone, but from door to door and over fence lines. Daily life in Rathmore moved at the pace of the seasons. Farming families rose early, creamery workers started their day before sunrise, and Sundays were sacred. A time for mass, rest, and seeing neighbours. The local creamery was a cornerstone of the village economy and social life, and it was there that 24-year-old Ellen O'Sullivan worked. She was the head buttermaker, a position of respect and responsibility for a young woman at the time. Ellen lived on the family farm just outside Rathmore in a townsland called Knocknalloman. She was known to be dependable, hard-working and well-liked in the community. She had been engaged for several years to Jeremiah Cronin, and like many courting couples of the era, they'd make a habit of setting aside time each Sunday to be together, often going for walks in the nearby countryside. Sunday the 8th of February 1931 began like many others. Ellen attended Mass, spent some of the day visiting relatives, and then made her way into Rathmore village to meet Jeremiah. At around 6:45 p.m. she left with her cousin and cycled into Rathmore. She and Jeremiah then set off for a walk together along the banks of the River Blackwater, which forms part of the Kerry-Cork border. She wheeled her bicycle and he walked beside her. The two were seen by others that evening exchanging greetings along the riverside track. It seemed like any ordinary, peaceful Sunday. At around 8:30 p.m. they parted ways near the track that led up to her house. Ellen began cycling home and Jeremiah went to retrieve his car from his cousin, who drove it to Shinnagh Cross, where he was waiting for Jeremiah with a few friends. Several witnesses later confirmed his whereabouts and movements. As I said, Ellen had begun cycling up the track to her home, but she would never make it home. When she hadn't returned by the time she generally did return, her parents weren't immediately alarmed. They thought perhaps she'd been delayed. But as the evening wore on and it got nearer to midnight, worry did begin to creep in. Her father went out with a lantern to search for her along the lanes, but he found no sign of her. Early the next morning, her bicycle was discovered abandoned at the side of the road, not far from her home, by a civic guard. That discovery triggered a large-scale search by the Gardaí and local volunteers. Still 5 long days passed before there was a breakthrough. A man walking on the Cork side of the river noticed something strange beneath a bush. Long strands of hair were poking out. On closer inspection, it was determined to be Ellen. Ellen's body had been carefully concealed under a dense bush, just beyond the Blackwater River on the Cork side, barely a field's length from the Kerry border. But her killer hadn't simply left her and fled. Ellen had been subjected to the most horrifically savage attack. Whoever had perpetrated the attack had knocked her from her bike and then dragged her through a gap in the ditch down to the river. He then pulled her across the shallow water to the other side of the river, crossing another field, and then he began to sexually assault her. Poor Ellen didn't just lie there, though, and take it. She fought back, prompting her attacker to grab a rock and hit her over the head with it. A subsequent autopsy carried out on Ellen's body revealed that the sexual assault actually continued long after Ellen had been murdered. Scattered across the surrounding area were fragments of Ellen's final moments, a silent but chilling breadcrumb trail of personal items and a lot of violence. Her hat was discovered first, trampled and partially buried under stones. A book, a belt, and a handkerchief were also found nearby, each one lying separately from the other, as if discarded deliberately or dropped in haste during a struggle. They weren't just left in a tidy heap. They were all strewn at intervals, possibly flung aside as Ellen was dragged across the uneven ground. Her underwear, however, was notably missing. A disturbing detail that pointed clearly to a sexually motivated attack. Only one shoe was found in the days that followed. Locals had seen it lying plainly on top of a wall, but it had gone unnoticed for days. It was blending in with the ditches and the gravel around, until eventually falling into the ditch, where it was finally recovered. But the most unsettling discovery came weeks later, actually over a month after the murder. Ellen's panties were located, not in a field, not at the river, but hidden in a cart cushion cover in a field near the home of two neighbours, David and Kathy O'Shea. The garment had been carefully tucked away in the stuffing, suggesting intent to conceal it. It was this discovery that would pull the O'Shea's deeper into the centre of the investigation eventually. Beyond Ellen's belongings, there were two other items that Gardaí believed belonged to the killer. Items not linked to Ellen, but rather left behind in the frenzy of violence. The first was a black leather legging, the type farmers wore strapped on over their trousers to protect them. It was found oddly placed on a small island in the middle of the river. It was a very odd place to find such an item, to be fair. Investigators believed the killer may have crossed the river during or after the attack, either to escape or dispose of evidence, and lost it there in the process. It could have even been lost as they were dragging Ellen across the water. The second item was a woolen sock, recovered from a field near the scene. It was the thick, coarse woolen kind that was worn by people who worked the land at the time. The sock had no identifying features, but its presence, like the leggings, didn't make sense unless it had come off during a physical struggle or a frantic fight. The positioning of these items did add to the theory that Ellen's attacker had forcibly dragged her across the landscape, over hedges, through shallow water, across uneven ground, and in doing so left behind physical traces of both himself and Ellen. With no modern forensics to rely on back in 1931, this kind of evidence took an outsized importance, you could say. These items potentially the only clues to the killer's identity. And taken together, the missing undergarments, the shoe left in plain sight, the personal items scattered, like, all over the place, after someone had obviously been in the fight for their lives. The scene told investigators that Ellen hadn't simply been attacked and abandoned. This had been deliberate, sustained, and deeply disturbing. It was now up to the Gardaí to figure out whose hands had been behind it, and whether those hands had also worn the woolen sock and owned the black leather legging. Gardaí first brought Ellen's fiancé, Jeremiah Cronin, in because he was the last person known to spend time with her. Standing at 5'5", strong and active, at around 10 stone, Ellen was far from defenceless and would have taken considerable strength to move her across fields, through hedgerows, and even across the shallow water of the Blackwater, especially if she was putting up a fight. All those factors made Cronin a logical initial suspect. However, within a very short time, multiple independent witnesses corroborated his account. He'd parted ways with Ellen, then travelled to Shinnacross Cross and retrieved his car from his cousin and drove approximately 7 miles home. His story held when his cousin and friends corroborated it. And after 9 days in custody, he was released uncharged. Authorities had to move on. They were forced by both the evidence and the alibis to start looking elsewhere. Now they focused their attention on David O'Shea, a 33-year-old man living nearby in Knocknalloman. And he lived with his sister Kathy. The O'Shea cottage lay adjacent to Ellen's family's land. Described as having limited mental capacity, David was known locally as a quite solitary worker, doing odd jobs and managing a small holding. The local newspapers described him as a loner, and his behaviour after the discovery of the body raised eyebrows. He refused to attend Ellen's removal or funeral. This was remarkable in rural County Kerry. When Gardaí questioned him, O'Shea admitted he had walked the Riverside Road on the evening of the 8th of February and acknowledged passing a couple matching the description of Ellen and Jeremiah. He claimed he continued towards Shinnagh Cross, arriving around 7 p.m, waited at the crossroads, stating no one else was there at the time, and then returned home later in the evening. His sister was asleep, seemingly, when he returned home at around 9 p.m, according to David. But O'Shea revised that story multiple times. Sometimes he said he didn't recognise Ellen or realise who she was. Other times he said he wasn't on that stretch of road at all. Another time he said he was going to visit his father but changed his mind. His shifting statements affected his credibility. As well as the disparity in his story, Gardaí questioning David noticed that his hands were covered in scratches. He said this had happened when he was cutting some undergrowth. Gardaí, of course, were suspicious that these scratches may have occurred when he was pulling Ellen's body through the bushes to hide it. From early in the investigation, detectives were under intense pressure. A brutal murder like this in a tight-knit rural area had shocked the entire county, let alone the village itself. The suspect list was narrow, and local sentiment demanded answers quickly. With Jeremiah Cronin cleared and no other suspects immediately apparent, Gardaí felt compelled to intensify their scrutiny of David O'Shea. Perhaps most compelling was the physical evidence and its alignment with a person familiar with the terrain and strong enough to overpower someone of Ellen's size. The scattered personal items, her missing undergarments, the black leather legging and the woolen sock found near the crime scene, along with the extensive scratches on his hands, these clues seemed to point towards someone local who knew the Riverside and the surrounding fields intimately. O'Shea lived nearby, walked those roads, and was described as physically capable enough to commit such an attack. Again, the community's familiarity with him weighed heavily in how suspicion evolved. Meanwhile, as I said, O'Shea's home was just over the fields from the O'Sullivans. He knew the local roads and laneways intimately, like most in the area, and his route that night placed him in the general vicinity of where Ellen was last seen. That proximity, combined with the irregularities in his account and his low profile in the days after the murder, meant Gardaí began looking at him more closely. At that stage, it was all observation. He hadn't been charged with anything, and nothing linked him directly to the crime. But in a case where the usual methods of investigation weren't available, like there is nowadays, no fingerprints, no forensics, no surveillance, everything hinged on people's stories, on movements, on memory. And O'Shea's didn't line up quite as neatly as others. Locals began sharing their memories of O'Shea with Garda investigators. They had seen David O'Shea wearing black leather leggings to mass in the autumn months preceding the disappearance of Ellen. Now, these weren't ordinary leggings, as I said. They were worn over trousers to guard the lower legs while walking across wet fields or scrubland. And such clothing was rare in that community. But when Gardaí asked, David insisted he owned only a brown pair and had blackened them with boot polish in order to go to mass. But no traces of this boot polish could be found on the leggings, and when asked why this was the case, David said that he hadn't polished them in months. It was only after the black legging was recovered from the small island in the middle of the river, near the scene of the crime, that those comments took on a new weight. That specific garment had a distinctive ribbed defect along one side, exactly matching damage neighbours claimed they'd seen on O'Shea's own pair at a dance one night. This witness was shown the legging that had been recovered from the island, and he identified them as the ones that had been worn by David O'Shea at the dance. Although circumstantial, it created a tangible link between O'Shea and one of the items found at the crime scene. Adding to that link, the local cobbler also stated that he had repaired a black leather legging for David in the past. Again, no direct proof these were the same garments. But where once there was only hearsay, you could say, investigators now had credible reports from local vendors, like the cobbler. A third-party account placing O'Shea in possession of matching attire. When Gardaí received permission to search the O'Shea cottage and its yard, they found something else curious. Under a mound of manure in the yard, they discovered rough fibrous stuffing, matching closely the kind used in the cart cushion cover where Ellen's missing underwear was found. This, of course, raised more questions. Was it waste from a piece of furniture, or was it a hiding place? At this stage, no overt link existed between that stuffing and the garment itself, but it was yet another jigsaw piece in the puzzle. Inconsistent stories, discarded items, unexplained concealment. O'Shea's statements had been checked and rechecked. His changing account of that riverside route, sometimes admitting he had seen the couple, sometimes denying recognition of the couple, flagged him to the investigators. Add to that, his presence in the immediate area, his proximity to where Ellen's body was discovered, and his sparse community interactions, and the discrepancies in timing and description. These all became more significant. Yet that still wasn't enough to arrest him. Witness testimony and circumstantial clues were interesting but insufficient. To arrest someone, Gardaí needed a confession or an eyewitness linking that person directly to the crime itself. And that didn't exist yet. What Gardaí had built was twofold. A set of personal inconsistencies and physical connections. On the personal side, O'Shea didn't behave as local custom demanded. He hadn't joined neighbours in the search. He hadn't appeared at the removal, and his sister was unable to account for when he actually returned home that fateful night, as she was already asleep. On the physical side, the black legging, the cobbler's testimony, and the discovery of the stuffing under the manure in the yard were enough to shift suspicion. Despite a growing dossier of circumstantial indicators, investigators still lacked a single piece of concrete evidence. No witness saw O'Shea with Ellen on the night she disappeared. There were no statements placing him with the victim after parting, and no direct evidence tied him to the crime act itself. In essence, the Gardaí were the closest they'd been since Cronin's exoneration, but still a distance from any arrest. The investigation needed either a confession, a witness to implicate him, or something magical in 1931 terms. Like someone overhearing damning conversations. It was clear, though, that without some dramatic breakthrough, the case was going to stall. By late March 1931, the Garda investigation into Ellen O'Sullivan's murder had built up a file of circumstantial evidence. Scattered clothing, local sightings, a suspicious legging, and shifting story. But none of it on its own tied anyone directly to the killing. They needed something more, a link between what they suspected and what could be said aloud. That's when a new approach emerged. As part of a planned second search of the O'Shea cottage, five Gardaí were dispatched to Knocknalomond. But this wasn't just any routine sweep. According to official statements later submitted in court, Garda Patrick Keane of Killarney was instructed to do something different. After arriving at the house, he positioned himself under the bed in Cathy O'Shea's bedroom, concealed from view. His job was to listen. Now, this wasn't a common tactic in Ireland at the time. Gardaí were still operating under evolving procedures. But the search party that day had a very specific goal: to hear what the O'Sheas might say when they believed the Gardaí had left. Gardaí Keane claimed that after the visible search had finished and the other officers had stepped outside, David and Cathy remained inside the cottage, unaware that he was under the bed. In his official statement, Keane later said he overheard a quiet but urgent conversation between the siblings. The topic? the very items Gardaí had been looking for. According to his version, Cathy began by saying, "My God, where is the legging? Did they take it?" With David replying, "See if it's behind the box. Look, quick, it's here." Then Cathy said, "Rush, quick. Take it away, quick, burn it." Keane didn't move. He waited, and the conversation, he said, continued, shifting to a sock, one that matched the kind found near the scene. Seemingly, according to Keane, David said, "What did you do with the sock?" With Cathy saying, "I was looking for it all day. I must burn it if I find it." And then she continued, "Didn't I tell you to brush your clothes when you came in that night? Wasn't it well we washed the pants?" Keane stayed hidden a little longer, listening until it was safe to slip out without being seen. That evening, after the team regrouped, the Gardaí acted quickly. Based on Keane's report and with the evidence they had already compiled, they moved to formally arrest David O'Shea. He was taken into custody and brought to Tralee Jail, where he was held for further questioning. Word of the arrest spread rapidly across Rathmore and the surrounding parishes. Some were relieved to hear someone had been taken in. Others were more cautious. David had long been seen as a quiet, if peculiar, man, not the sort many imagined capable of such violence. But his behaviour in the weeks since Ellen's disappearance had unsettled even those who knew him best. The day after his arrest, Gardaí returned to the O'Shea cottage for another, more thorough search, this time with a new sense of purpose. And it was during this visit that they found another item of interest. A grey woolen sock tucked inside an old milk tankard in David's bedroom. It closely resembled the one that they already had as evidence. Now, these socks wouldn't have been mass-produced factory socks like we have nowadays. They were rough and hand-knitted, the kind worn, as I said, by working men. Finding a matching sock at the suspect's house after hearing talk of hiding or burning such an item added fuel to the suspicion. They also noted signs that some items had recently been burned in the yard, including singed scraps of fabric and remains of coarse wool in an ash pile. While no definitive link was made at that time between those remains and Ellen's missing clothing, the timing did raise eyebrows. Meanwhile, Cathy O'Shea, though not arrested, was also questioned extensively. She confirmed certain aspects of her brother's movements that night, but denied that any conversation like the one described by Keane had ever taken place. She also insisted that neither she nor her brother had ever discussed disposing of evidence, nor buried anything suspicious. Still, momentum of the case had shifted. With David O'Shea now in custody, Gardaí had, for the first time, a suspect formally detained and under scrutiny. They continued interviewing neighbours, gathering witness statements and documenting the timeline. But they knew the case would rest heavily on what had just allegedly happened, that reported conversation inside the cottage. Whether it would stand up to questioning or scrutiny later remained to be seen. For now, in the eyes of the investigators, they finally had what they needed to move the case forward. By August of 1931, the investigation into Ellen O'Sullivan's murder had culminated in formal charges against David O'Shea. His trial took place at the Central Criminal Court in Dublin, presided over by Justice Hanna. It was said to be one of the most closely watched and controversial murder trials in the young Irish Free State. The prosecution's central piece of evidence was the verbal testimony provided by Civic Guard Patrick Keane, the same officer who had hidden under Cathy O'Shea's bed during the second cottage search. When Keane took the stand, he repeated in court what he claimed he had overheard that day, a hushed conversation between Cathy and David about disposing of the legging and the sock. Keane testified he waited patiently while the cottage seemed to be searched thoroughly. Then when other officers left, he heard the siblings speak in urgent, deliberate tones. This testimony formed the crux of the prosecution's narrative, that the siblings were aware of and planning to dispose of physical evidence linking David to the crime scene. Cathy and David O'Shea both denied that this conversation ever took place and testified to this in court. Although these testimonies did nothing to help David's case, Cathy swore that she had not discussed the murder with her brother at all after the first raid, which to the prosecution was unbelievable. It was also felt by her answers under cross-examination that she knew more than she would admit about David's part in Ellen's murder. David, for his part, when he gave his testimony again, was riddled with inconsistencies, which from the outside looking in, looked like he was lying under oath. He denied that he was any way familiar with the area from which Ellen had been kidnapped and subsequently murdered, despite the fact he had lived there all his life. He also denied knowing that Ellen was engaged to Jeremiah Cronin and continued with the narrative that he did not recognise them when he saw the couple down by the river. The fact he hadn't joined in the search for Ellen or attend her wake did little to help his case either. And his misleading account of his movements on the evening of the 8th of February to all who listened confirmed his guilt. All it did was reaffirm to everybody that he had no alibi for the time of the murder and was lying to conceal that fact. After several days of testimony, over 60 witnesses examined, the jury retired to consider its verdict. Before retiring to consider their verdict, the judge began his summing up, which did little again to help David's defence, as he started by talking about necrophilia, which would have undoubtedly reminded the jury of the savagery of the attack on poor Ellen. The judge also instructed them to evaluate both the physical evidence and the plausibility of the overheard statements. When talking about the alleged overheard conversation by Civic Guard Keane, the judge said that if he had invented this conversation, he was the devil out of hell, before concluding that he didn't think a member of the Civic Guard would ever do such a thing, and that the dialogue sounded so natural that if he had made it up, he had the ability of a playwright. Jurors were also asked to consider whether David's erratic explanations about his movements, missing items, and failure to attend Ellen's funeral reflected criminal consciousness. Finally, the judge asked the jury to consider the question of premeditation, which was an important question in deciding whether David should hang if he was found guilty. The jury returned a verdict of guilty of murder by saying, "We believe this was an unpremeditated act committed during a period of mental abnormality." They urged special consideration because of O'Shea's mental state. Judge Hannah accepted the verdict and passed the mandatory death sentence, but promised that their comments would be passed on to the appropriate authorities for consideration. The plea that the statement amounted to a guilty but insane verdict would later be rejected by the British Privy Council Appeals Court, which meant David was due to hang. It was the first such appeal to London since the formation of the Irish Free State. Now, very little has been recorded about O'Shea's final days and hours. What we do know is that he was kept in the condemned cell at Mountjoy under close watch. It's likely he was offered the services of a priest, as was customary at the time, and that he was probably visited by the prison chaplain. Whether he received any visitors that evening, perhaps his sister Cathy, isn't clearly documented. But in keeping with Irish tradition, he would have been offered the chance to settle his conscience and to prepare for what was to come. At 6:30 a.m, David O'Shea awoke for the last time. Mass was said in his cell, guards prepared him, and at around 8 a.m, he was led to the gallows. The execution was carried out by Albert Pierpoint, the British hangman who would later become notorious for his efficiency and for executing over 400 people during his career. On this occasion, he was accompanied by his assistant, Robinson. Eyewitness accounts say that O'Shea walked calmly to the scaffold, showing no signs of resistance or panic. When asked, as was required by protocol, why the sentence should not be carried out, he reportedly replied softly, "Because I am not guilty, sir." No other last words were recorded. Moments later, the trapdoor opened, and just like that, it was all over. A formal inquest was held shortly afterwards inside the prison. It confirmed that the execution had been carried out according to the law. The official death notice was signed by the prison governor and posted on the gates of Mountjoy, as was custom. But while all was silent inside those walls, outside a crowd had gathered, long before the scheduled hour. From about 7:30 that morning, groups began to form near the gates. It wasn't a rowdy protest or anything like that, or even a vigil in the traditional sense. It was just a quiet gathering. Mostly women and girls standing with rosary beads in their hands. A few men were there too. As the time approached, they knelt together in prayer. The men removed their hats, heads were bowed. They simply waited in silence and prayer until the white paper was pinned to the gate confirming David O'Shea was dead. Now, it's important to understand the crowd outside Mountjoy that day weren't necessarily protesting his innocence. In fact, most seemed to believe he probably had committed the crime. But what unsettled many was how the case had been handled. The idea that a civic guard had hidden under a bed in the O'Shea home and only reported an incriminating conversation didn't sit well with a lot of people. Even at the time, it was seen by some as manipulative, a method that crossed a moral line, even if it did help secure a conviction. That mood was captured in a striking way by Time magazine, which published a piece shortly after the execution, in which they wrote, "A morbid crowd cursed the Irish police that hanged him. It was not that they thought David O'Shea innocent, but to the Irish mind, he had been caught by unfair means. Irishmen expect sportsmanship in their policemen." Even in death, David O'Shea remained a deeply divisive figure. Some believe justice had been served, others believe it had been bent. And many, even those who accepted his guilt, were left with a lingering discomfort, not over what had been proven, but over how it had been proven. After his execution in Mountjoy, David O'Shea was almost certainly buried in an unmarked grave within the prison grounds. That was standard practice in Ireland at the time for those who were hanged, so that he'd have no headstone, there'd be no ceremony and no records made public. It would have been a quite state-managed process, designed to avoid unrest and keep the moment contained. To this day, there's no confirmed burial site for David O'Shea and no marker bearing his name. Despite exhaustive searches through press archives, including the Irish Independent, the Kerryman and local Kerry papers, no death notice or obituary for Ellen O'Sullivan could be located. Media coverage focused entirely on the murder, the investigation and the trial. While it is probable that she received a traditional church funeral and was laid to rest in the local graveyard near her home, no formal record of her burial appears in any of the newspapers that I checked. This is one of those cases that just kind of plays on your mind, not just because of what happened to Ellen, but because of how the whole thing was handled. The investigation, the arrest, the trial, it all felt, I don't know, unsettling. And in the middle of it, there was a man whose guilt was never entirely proven and a community that were trying to make sense of something that had basically shaken them to their very core. We'll probably never know for sure if justice was truly done. What we do know is that a young woman's life was taken in the most brutal way, and everything after that became a scramble to find answers, maybe too quickly, maybe not carefully enough. Ellen O'Sullivan wasn't just a name in a case file. She had a job that she was good at, people who loved her, plans for the future. She was engaged to be married. And while her life was stolen in the most brutal way, what followed felt rushed, uncertain. In the end, it leaves you really asking a question that there's no answer to, really. Was there one victim in this case, or was there two? I'll let you guys be the judge of that.
So guys, that's it for today's episode of the Ireland Crimes and Mysteries podcast. Again, thanks for your listenership, and don't forget to subscribe to the show and hit that auto-download so you never miss an episode. Until the next time, keep your eyes open and your mind curious. This podcast has been compiled from information gathered in the public sphere, like news articles, documentaries, and open source material that can be found on the web. Everything in this podcast is alleged unless a conviction has taken place.